Commonwealth. Mr. Kite, Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, yes.
We got a little ahead of ourselves because we had a couple cases drop off the docket, so even though your former boss over here wants to hold you in contempt, we won't do that.
There was a wreck on the interstate that held me up for an hour in Charlottesville, so.
That would be a double punishment for this, I think, then, if we did anything further.
Yes, thank you.
And I don't think you were supposed to be here till 10 anyway, so you were.
Just made it.
All right. I'm not sure who was here when, but I'll let everybody know, we do not have timing lights here. I'll keep the time from the bench, and I'll let you know when you're into your rebuttal. Mr. Kite, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, Judge.
Okay. You may begin when you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. Police the court, my name is Shannon Kite, and I represent Ms. Taylor in this appeal. The trial court erred when it convicted Ms. Taylor of the battery on two grounds. First off, her conduct did not exceed the bounds of a lawful parental discipline, and secondly, the misdemeanor was not timely prosecuted under 19.2-8. Now, the brief facts, which are pertinent because of the time issues here, she was charged via direct indictment on April the 15th of 2013, and she was charged with a felony offense of 40.1-103. It's not in dispute that Ms. Taylor was the child's guardian. She was her de facto step-parent in raising the child. During the bench trial, the evidence presented by the Commonwealth was unable to establish a felony conviction, but the court, at the conclusion of the evidence, did find Ms. Taylor guilty of a misdemeanor battery, which it determined was a lesser-included offense. Specifically, the act in question was a backhanded strike of the child while it was doing homework. Now, in relationship to the lawful discipline, whether an act is a battery depends on the intent of the actor. And the court has held through Carpenter versus Commonwealth and numerous others that when dealing with child rearing, the parent has a right to punish the child reasonably, but must not exceed the bounds of moderation and must not be cruel. The current case deals with a backhanded slap of the child as he is doing homework. There's no evidence of physical or lasting injury. There is just the air that was knocked out of the child. The court rarely sees battery offenses of this type brought before it. It's usually malicious or unlawful woundings, dealing with scaldings or beatings to the point blood is drawn.
Wasn't the testimony here, though, that the child was not misbehaving in any way, that he just asked her for help on the homework and she hit him in the chest then?
That was the nugget that was put in front of the court. There was also nothing there to establish, you know, what was his behavior leading up to that. Was he being disrespectful, belligerent, whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, regardless if the discipline is not conventional, not desirable, it has to be merciless. It has to be beyond the bounds of moderation. And in this case, the results of it did not leave a whelp, did not leave a mark. It basically knocked the air out of him. And I believe the child stated that it knocked the air out of him, he was scared, and then he was fine.
Well, he had trouble breathing afterwards.
Yes, and just as if you were startled, or you know, certain times when even a spanking, I propose, could have the air be knocked out of the child, or have trouble breathing because he's upset. And I would submit that in many traditional spankings that the court and society in general deem acceptable, that there's more of a physical toll placed upon the child than a 10-second discomfort.
Well, isn't the question of whether this was reasonable or not a factual determination?
It is a factual determination, and it is also something that's up for review as well in relation to the other cases brought before the court.
And doesn't that depend to some extent on whether the court should determine that this was I don't want to use the word punishment, but it was an attempt to correct misbehavior as opposed to trying to injure the child or trying to inflict pain on the child.
It is, and to that effect, there was no evidence presented that Ms. Taylor acted in anger or with passion, just that the child was doing homework, the homework was incorrect, and he was a blow was delivered to him. And that was the crux of it. And the court, based on that, found Ms. Taylor guilty of the battery, which therein lies the second problem, is that the statute of limitations on that issue with the misdemeanor lesser included offense.
Let me
yes,
ask you before
yes.
we move on.
Certainly.
The original indictment was under, 40.1-103,
yes.
And Is assault and battery, are you conceding assault and battery is a lesser included offense?
I think we have to, because it does say or beaten. And any time there is a beaten, I believe a battery would have to occur. That is right. Something that is beyond a simple battery. So I think for that purposes, we would have to concede that. And so in finding the lesser included leads us into the second part brought before the court today, is the statute of limitations. And the case at bar, the indictment was brought April the 15th, 2013. And in the language of the indictment, as well as the facts presented at trial, the last possible date for the battery to have occurred is February 23rd of 2012.
This was never prosecuted as a misdemeanor. Right?
It was not. It was brought as a felony, and that's when the action was commenced. There's no doubt that because this is brought as a felony, for a felony conviction, clearly no statute of limitations problem. I think that the Commonwealth would agree that if this was brought initially as a battery, it would be time barred. But we're in that gray area, and it's not a fertile ground for case law in Virginia. And the commonly held majority... It's not a fertile ground. No, so there, it's very, very few cases for direction. And the commonly held majority view, which is referenced in brief by both parties, is that once the statute of limitation runs for the lesser included misdemeanor, that offense is time barred. And I believe there is Kane versus State, a Delaware case, and a State versus King, a West Virginia case, that was cited, and they obviously have a litany cited in their citations. But this state does have Hall versus Commonwealth, and it gives the court direction on this issue. Hall states it involves, the facts involve the theft of phone services. The charge was brought as a felony, it was amended as a misdemeanor. But there was no problem with statute of limitations there because the felony was brought within the 1 year time period. Now, the court in Hall held that the fact that the warrant charged a felony does not bar prosecution for a lesser included offense or lesser included misdemeanor, so long as the prosecution was commenced within the applicable limitation period. And what's more telling is that there is a footnote. They painstakingly take the time to state that most authorities agree that the commencement for a felony prosecution after the running of the limitation period for a necessarily included misdemeanor offense would result in a bar to a conviction for the lesser offense. This appears to be the majority view and what Hall is promoting. The Commonwealth, via brief, is asking this court to adopt the minority or the opposite view, and stating basically in support of that the misdemeanor action was not commenced by the felony action. The statute of limitations, 19.2-8, requires prosecution to be commenced within 1 year.
In this case, the trial court did not issue a bench warrant prior to finding him guilty of assault and battery, did it?
They did not, and that was the Ainge matter where after the acquittal they issued the bench warrant after the statute.
If it were not a part of the felony indictment, I'm just wondering how would the trial court have convicted him if he were not substantially charged with the misdemeanor at the time the felony indictment was returned?
Well, if I'm understanding the question, if the Commonwealth brings this offense, the current offense, within the 1 year statute of limitations, every possibility and every misdemeanor, lesser included, felony, whatever it may be, is available to the court to find Ms. Taylor guilty. Here, by their own actions, they waited an additional 3 months outside of that window. And the commencement, the statute of limitations requires commencement. It doesn't say commencement via felony or via misdemeanor, just a commencement. The commencement is the beginning. And I submit to the court, how do we have an ending and a finality of this matter if we never have a beginning? And the theory is flawed because the Commonwealth here...
How do you respond to that West Virginia, that case that you referred to a moment ago, mm-hmm. King, that said, you know, in many... I think I'm thinking of the right one now, but
yes.
that says, look, in felonies, it often takes more than a year to bring everything together to even start the prosecution.
It does. And in this case, to distinguish that, is for felony offenses, we have 2 points. Number one, we have two different statute of limitations for misdemeanors versus felonies. The felonies are more serious matters. That's why if you commit a break and entering, you are on the hook for here until whenever. But trespasses, things that are not as serious, there comes a conclusion time. And Kane states about, you know, there is a time that takes additional time, et cetera. The Commonwealth made this situation because they did not bring it within the 1 year. Ms. Taylor was not avoiding prosecution. There was no additional research or investigation that happened once the child was removed. In fact, during the time the indictment was brought, she was incarcerated serving time on a totally unrelated matter. They knew where to find her. It's a concern in general, but yet for this particular matter, Ms. Taylor was right there waiting to be served. They limited their own options by their own actions. And what they're in essence doing is they're asking this court to now save them from it. And in mentioning the Cain matter, there are two reasons, if you will, among others, for the statute of limitations. One is to make sure the evidence is fresh, it's not stale, the prosecution can best prosecute it, the defense has access to the witnesses to best defend himself. But also there is the closure of the offense. And to that end, Cain also states, and if I may read, the statute of limitations may also be viewed as statutes of repose. Even a person who has committed a criminal act is entitled, after the passage of some time, to conduct his affairs on the assumption they will not be disrupted by criminal prosecution. This is particularly true in the case of someone who ceased to engage in criminal activity and is leading a law-abiding life. The Commonwealth made this situation because they failed to act, and now they're asking this court to salvage the misdemeanor conviction. By delaying, they limited themselves to felony or acquittal.
Didn't ask the trial judge to impose the misdemeanor. That was the trial judge's action.
It was the trial judge's actions, but by waiting to bring that indictment after the one-year period, then they, in essence, limited the possible options of being a rightful felony conviction or not.
I guess your argument is the Commonwealth has got to be a little more realistic in its charging decision up front and get it in, if it's only a misdemeanor, charge the misdemeanor in a timely manner.
Certainly, and in this particular case, there was nothing. If they thought it was a felony and genuinely believed that, even though the court did not agree with them, that's fine. But if they would bring that matter, there was no cause for delay, and in the delay, that was their own decision, limited the possible outcomes that they had available to them.
Okay, Mr. Kite, you're into your rebuttal time.
Okay, well, thank you, Judge. Thank you.
Mr. Kim.
Good morning. May it please the court. Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. As to assignment of error one, I would mainly rely on my brief, unless the court has any questions on that matter. I think it's a factual finding that this corporal punishment defense exceeded the bounds of moderation, and I think that factual finding is entitled to deference and should be upheld if the court reaches that issue. Obviously, the more troublesome issue in the Commonwealth's view is probably assignment of error two.
Seems like you and the state of Georgia are on your own on this one. Everybody else disagrees with you.
Yeah, the state of Georgia, there are some states that by statute have enacted legislation that allows this, Maine and Utah.
As Virginia could.
True. And our argument is purely statutory, that we can read our two statutes that deal in this case as being like those statutes in Maine and Utah and the minority view of Georgia. And this is what we have is we have the misdemeanor statute 19.2-8 that talks about a misdemeanor has to be commenced within a year. A prosecution has to be commenced. Versus the other statute is 19.2-285, which deals with a jury or a fact finder's ability to convict of a lesser included offense of a greater offense.
But doesn't that statute require, in order to be convicted of the lesser offense, that it be substantially charged in the indictment?
Yes.
So why wouldn't the assault in this case be substantially charged in the indictment for abuse, in the felony indictment?
I believe our position that it was substantially charged.
And that indictment came after the statute of limitations on that had run.
Of the misdemeanor, but not the felony.
But the misdemeanor is a part of the felony.
Is a part of the felony, yes. But it is our position that the commencement of the action was not anything that the Commonwealth did. This was.
Well, was it ever commenced, in your opinion?
That the misdemeanor.
Misdemeanor.
That the misdemeanor was commenced. What we are saying is that the a commencement of a misdemeanor is commence when there is a new warrant issued or an indictment is amended to a misdemeanor.
He must, or she must have been charged at some point with the misdemeanor in order to be convicted of the misdemeanor. Am I wrong on that?
Our view is that when the trial court adjudicated her of the lesser included offense, that's not really a commencement of under
when
the statute.
When was it commenced? What commenced the misdemeanor charge? What charging document commenced it?
Well, it would be the indictment for the felony, and that we're relying on. That is the commencement of the action. It's encompassed in the felony.
So the misdemeanor charge was commenced outside of the one-year statute of limitation period because the indictment was returned outside of that 1 year.
I know, it's sort of going around in a little bit in circular.
Well, West Virginia, and I guess there was a day when West Virginia was part of this great commonwealth. West Virginia has the same statute suite, it has the same statute limitations, and has an identical statute to 19.2-285. And the West Virginia Supreme Court addressed the relation between those two in State v. King and held to the contrary. Why shouldn't we follow that?
Well, a couple things about the West Virginia case. One, it wasn't unanimous. There was a two-judge dissent in that case. And then the other thing about the West Virginia case that I, in reviewing it yesterday, that I found interesting is that they seem to say that a conviction that falls outside of the statute of limitations is void. And I don't think that's the law of this commonwealth, because the statute of limitations can be waived, and therefore is not void. So I think that was part of their reasoning of that case.
Counsel, what's your take on the Hall decision?
Well, the Hall decision was a situation where the commonwealth was amending an indictment to a misdemeanor, and so I don't think it really addresses the situation we have in this case.
Well, what's the difference between the commonwealth amending the indictment to the misdemeanor and the trial court effectively amending the indictment to a misdemeanor?
And I think that's the difference is your word effectively, and we're not saying that that's the same. That what the commonwealth is doing is recommencing a new prosecution.
You have no new charging document.
Right.
You have no new process issued. You are relying upon the indictment originally returned by the grand jury in both instances.
Yeah. And the difference being is the stage of the prosecution. We have these statute of limitations on the front end that you can't, that the Commonwealth cannot, we agree, you can't bring a misdemeanor outside the 1 year statute of limitations. But we also want to be able to convict people who have committed crimes if it's included within the greater offense.
So you're making a public policy argument to us.
Partially, yeah. It's statutory, and there is a public policy argument that goes along.
Shouldn't that be made to the General Assembly?
I mean, I understand. But
let me ask you about Hall. Suppose in Hall the case had been tried, all the evidence had been presented. The Commonwealth, realizing that the evidence was not quite as strong as he or she originally imagined it would be, and said, Your Honor, we agree that we have not established the felony. The best we've done is establish the misdemeanor. Would that change the outcome of Hall at all? Because he made the motion to reduce it to a misdemeanor at the end of trial as opposed to the commencement?
No, I don't think it would, because he's still making a motion to amend it. And I think it's a limitation on what the Commonwealth can do. My argument is not so much a policy, it is partially a policy argument, but also a legislative intent. Are we saying in 19.2-285 that statute is subject to the statute of limitations? Or are we saying that we treat fact finders differently than the Commonwealth? and that therefore, let me step back. I've lost my train of thought a little bit, but
that's fine. This is a tough case for me. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a little bit on the sort of public policy end, because we realize the General Assembly, if it chooses to enact a statute on this, would resolve the question. But given where we are now, is there a danger if we say, well, you can do this, you can essentially indict more than a year later and go for a felony, is there a danger that can be abused? Because then you go, down to the situation of, well, we wouldn't have indicted for anything but a misdemeanor if we could have done so, but now we're indicting for a felony and hoping to get a lesser included conviction for a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't think that the very many Commonwealth attorneys are going to try to indict for felonies just so they can get a misdemeanor, for one. And then we also have, procedural roadblocks in place that they have to be able to have a probable cause to bring that felony in the first place, through.
Well, when we talk about, we talk about statutory construction, one of the things we look at is whether the General Assembly, whether we have issued an opinion on the matter, and whether the General Assembly has made any changes. In Hall, we came pretty much to issuing an opinion on this, and then, as I said, the overwhelming weight of authority around the country is to the contrary of your argument. If the General Assembly didn't agree with that, why wouldn't the General Assembly have not amended the statute?
Well, I think you said that you've almost ruled on it, and so they never. You never ruled on it.
We put a footnote in there that was pretty close.
Are you suggesting the footnote was dicta in Hall?
Well, yeah, it definitely was dicta.
It was dicta.
I mean, it wasn't a ruling or a holding. It was dicta.
We do that now and then.
So what authority is that for us if it was dicta?
I mean, it's persuasive authority. I mean, just like all the other case law that's out there. I know that the weight of authority is against the Commonwealth in this case. I mean, I do have the Georgia cases that they seem to be fine with this. I'll admit that I've done the research on the Georgia cases, and it just seems like it's always been that way in Georgia since the 1800s.
Yeah. Are the Georgia statutes like the West Virginia statutes very similar to ours?
And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer.
In reading, I think one of the original Georgia cases is Jenks versus State.
Yeah.
And in reading that, it looked to me like the rule was based more on the court's outrage about the facts of the case than it was about the law.
And that may be your reading of it.
Apparently the defendant had impregnated the prosecutor's daughter and then refused to marry her and ended up with 20 years in the penitentiary.
Right. And I have no answer to that, obviously.
Anyway.
But basically, it boils down to what we're looking at is that the language talks about commencing a prosecution, and the prosecutor in this case did what they could do. They commenced a felony, and the trial court came in.
How do you respond to Mr. Kite that, well, look, this isn't really that hard of a case. It's not like some massive felony that takes a while to put your evidence together, and they could have indicted within a year. She was easily locatable. And just why not do it within a year? Why wait a year and 3 months?
And I don't know the exact timeline here, but
I think it's about 2 or 3 months over the year.
2 or 3 months over the year. Now, maybe in this case, but in child abuse cases like this, it's probably not going to be the case that you want to hastily
find out within a year.
Yeah, find out within a year.
But she was under house arrest in the house for a good bit of time, the testimony was. And then I guess she was incarcerated later.
Right. Yeah. Apparently she couldn't walk into the bus stop because she was under house arrest and that sort of thing.
All right, Ms. Campbell, your time is up. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Kites, you've got your rebuttal time remaining.
Just for a brief response. On the Hall matter, just want to clarify that one thing that has been overlooked is that the felony warrant in that situation was obtained October of 1978, and the offenses were from July, August, of September of that same year. It just took them forever to find him and serve him. So the actual charges were commenced in a timely manner, even for the misdemeanor. And Hall does leave this court and the jurisdiction with a breadcrumb trail as to where exactly they feel this issue should be resolved. And in dealing with the statutes, other states have enacted statutes to fix, if you will, a problem like this. And this legislature has not acted. And the fact that these other jurisdictions had to enact legislation to broaden the possible culpability of the defendant shows how jurisdictions agree that there is a limiting amount of time that you can bring these misdemeanors, and they have to be brought in a timely manner in order to keep these lesser included offenses alive for potential conviction.
Counsel, do you know if the Georgia statutes are similar or comparable to the Virginia statutes?
I apologize to the court, I do not. I'm in a like situation with my colleague there. But it is the overwhelming authority and the majority authority. We would ask this court to follow that, and basically that this was time barred. And this, especially troubling here, is the Commonwealth did have it in their discretion to bring this 3 months earlier, and they did not. But as a more broader situation, or more broad situation, once the statute and once the year is up, there is a finality that comes with possible culpability for those people who have moved on, and there is just a peace of mind element. And in this situation, by the Commonwealth's own actions, they made it either a felony or an acquittal.
It's your argument that to be timely, the indictment should have been brought by the 23rd of February of 2013? Is that right?
Yes, February of that year would have been on or about. I mean, the court could never pinpoint, because of the testimony of the child, exactly when. It may have happened a couple of days or a few weeks later, but even in the charging document itself, the broadest it could have possibly been would have been February. That still makes the April indictment 2 months outside of that window. So even given the Commonwealth the benefit of the doubt for the timing, it still falls outside of that window. And that would be our request and our position. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. We